coming up on Tech Nation, my new bespoke French stove, or rather the people and company who built it, a business which has been in tiny Lacanche, France, since before the French Revolution. It thrives today, having changed with the times in some ways, and definitely not in others. It's a story of technology and manufacturing and choice. Let's just say they don't teach this in business school. I speak with Jean-Jacques Auganeur, the CEO of Lacanche, as well as the director of export, Chef Patrick Bougeot. All this coming up on this week's Tech Nation.
Let's take five with Moira Gunn. This is 5 minutes.
Sticks and stones may break my bones, but names will never hurt me. That was a popular refrain when I was young. Whether parents or somebody else's parents or anyone in authority for that matter, when you were outraged that someone called you a name, you can count on that old line being rolled out in response. At one level, it was sort of a, kid, get over it. At another, it was attempting to inoculate you against bad behavior. At still another, the person saying it had abdicated any responsibility to take action, which only occurred to me recently. After a few decades passed, I'm a parent, in California, and times had indeed changed. Preschools had 3- and 4-year-olds face each other, acknowledge the hurt of their words, and make an effort, and yes, I'm quoting here, to fix their feelings. Quite a distance from get over it, kid. In fact, you're not supposed to get over it. More times than not, calling people names is far more deeply hurtful and long-lasting than sticks and stones. It's a stick and a stone, all in one. I don't mean to say that name-calling was supported or even ignored, but there was no catchy refrain for don't call people names, it's hurtful, or saying things just to hurt people is bad. There was no pithy line ready for the circumstance. And if you analyze that sticks and stones line, you might come up with the argument that you could call other people names, and it's not going to hurt them. So who cares? It feels good to evacuate your own bad feeling by saying something awful to someone else. To borrow from the law, no harm, no foul. But nobody buys that. If there was no foul, all us kids would not be complaining about our sibling when mom and dad were out of earshot, or little Johnny down the street, or Polly while standing in line for recess and the whole class could hear. You bet it hurts. And it doesn't just hurt children. It hurts every living, breathing human being at any age. And now today, instead of everyone in the school cafeteria, anyone can say horrible things about anybody else 24/7 to the whole world via social media. Oh, I'll just use an example here. Say, on Twitter. Here's the cycle. A person with a huge following, including all the global news media, is without bounds when it comes to saying whatever pops into his head. There are layers on layers of hurt palpable in his tweets. And let's just focus on the adjectives. Fake, sick, biased, sad, dishonest, failing, vicious, incompetent, unpopular, sleazy, weak and terrible. You might as well throw in crooked, lying, and crying. And what are these? They are name-calling. While name is a noun, I'm pointing at adjectives. It's like driving the getaway car. It's the same crime. As a journalist, I can tell you they are subjective and not objectively descriptive. And if you are the target, it hurts palpably. And worse, if you believe that people believe that adjective, if it sticks, interesting use of the word, then you will feel threatened, which was the intent. But hey, big news, we grew up. We built social media, and we can rebuild it now that we have experience with it. We can make disparaging language unacceptable because free speech can't be free. If you're afraid, you will be attacked. I'm Moira Gunn. This is 5 Minutes.
Five Minutes is produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. 5 Minutes is a production of Tech Nation Media. I'm Paul Lancour.
From San Francisco, I'm Moira Gunn, and this is Tech Nation. Today on Tech Nation, well, actually, it started 5 years ago. That's right. 5 years ago, I decided that what I really wanted for myself, simply for me, was a French stove. I looked around and I discovered that there was one that spoke to me. It took me 5 years, and in that time, I remained faithful to the size, to the main options, and to even the color I liked upon sight. What I didn't know was anything about the people who build it, the company behind it, and the place they call home. For once, Wikipedia was not particularly helpful. There is only one tiny photo, LaConcha's church and churchyard, clearly taken as a quick shot from across the street, with not a car in sight. A line map of France with a black dot marking the location of the town, and a short list of population trends starting in 1968, the most recent figure 10 years ago. Needless to say, LaConcha is not a hotbed of social media. But in the Middle Ages, LaConcha had resources. Iron and other metals were right there in the ground. You could just dig up the earth, and with plentiful water to wash it and wood to create fire, melt them out. That's right, you could produce metal. So about 1,000 years ago, give or take a century, the metal that was coveted for agricultural use, for stirrups and riding horses, for weapons and for decoration, were produced in LaConcha. The arc of this technology, from those early times, through the French Revolution, through the Industrial Revolution, and more, is still in LaConcha today, still a sleepy little village, still involved in metalworking, where they actually produced my stove. I knew nothing of any of this for those 5 years, or even when I ordered it, and yet by happenstance, I found that I would be in Paris. Could I come down and visit the LaConcha factory? And indeed I could. At the time of my visit, I knew that they had built my stove and that it was on the high seas, making its way to Los Angeles by boat and then on to San Francisco. I happily made the 185-mile trip down to the village of LaConcha, 3.5 hours from Paris, mostly on modern highways, but then the last perhaps hour over 2-lane country roads, through vineyards and tiny farms, slowing occasionally to drive through a typical French village. And then finally, with the help of GPS, we found LaConcha. I must tell you that it was not until after my stove was fully underway and they had already agreed to a visit that I asked them for an interview. Here they were most gracious as well. You will hear that interview today and see how the arc of technology always reaches us from some starting point, in this case from the Middle Ages in remote France, to a present-day business with a surprising and original take on technology that may cause us to think about how we might build technology in a different way. I was able to speak with Jean-Jacques Augeneur, the CEO of LaConcha, as well as the director of export, Chef Patrick Boisjot. Jean-Jacques, we are here in LaConcha, France.
Mm-hmm.
Tell everyone, where are we? Place us in the world.
Yeah, it's LaConcha is a small village located in the heart of Burgundy, the Burgundy region, which is just between Paris and the Riviera. And on the Midway, more accurately. and deep in the countryside with beautiful landscapes and vineyards and full of French culture and gastronomy inspiration.
And yet, Lacanche, France, is a very small place.
It's a very, very small place, actually. It's a small village next to a more famous little city that is named Beaune, on the main wine street, actually, in Burgundy. And there are here 650 people living in this village.
Now, I would suspect that you are the biggest company here. In
probably.
The 650 member population village?
Population village, yes. And there are altogether 130 people working in this company.
This village has historically worked with iron and metal. Tell us about it.
Yes. Basically, that the reason why there is a village focused on industry and metal working, actually, is just because there were a lot of iron. There have always been a lot of mines, little iron mining in the area.
And that started. Iron's just in the ground.
Absolutely. As a raw material. And it started very early in the history, actually in the Middle Age, where a foundry was set up, actually, in the 12th, 13th century. So, and since then, there has always been an activity, an industry focused on metal working, actually. Jean-Baptiste de Richard de Curtil, he was an aristocrat, basically. And that guy died during the French Revolution in 1792. As the time during that period in France was a little bit erratic with the French Revolution, the company or the plant was confiscated by the French Revolution, the government, and was sold in an auction, actually, to somebody who was involved in the business and the trade of iron, basically. And the company was kept in the same hands, in the same family, for almost two centuries.
But around 1800, we started with the Industrial Revolution.
Yes.
Big time.
Yes, exactly. And the needs were totally different. Even if some people say that during the Napoleon Wars, there have been a lot of bullets made in Lacanche, actually. Later on, the workshop specialized in cooking equipment, pots, and any kind of cast iron utensils.
Okay, so time passes. We go through all of the 1800s and most of the 1900s, and we get to the 1970s, and the company changed hands.
Yes, absolutely, because, I mean, the people habits changed very much so, and the houses became even more comfortable, and people had to cook. The coal industry produced a lot of coal that was available for heating, for cooking, etc. And then some specific equipment were required by people, actually, like cookers or heaters, and that was the next step, the next chapter of the Lacanche development.
And in the meantime, people got electricity, gas could come into your house.
Mm-hmm.
The whole idea, you just go up to your range, you don't have to build a fire.
Exactly. So you have to adapt yourself and to adapt your production according to the energy supply and the safety requirements. So you have to seek for new components, to develop your own components as well. And that's what happened. And they came to a kind of more mass production, I would say.
So in the 70s, after how many generations for 200 years, they sold the company.
And they sold the company, yes, after six or seven generations. So my father took over in 1982, and we decided together to relaunch the name of Lacanche that disappeared more or less in the 50s, 60s. And this is a rebirth at some point, and we are glad we have done that, actually, because the Lacanche brand is now quite famous all over the world, and it's a kind of embassy for the French gastronomy and the French culture at some point, yeah.
Well, I have to tell everybody, because some people know that I love to cook, and you didn't know anything about this. I bought a Lacanche stove and said, by the way, I'd like to come to Lacanche. And you were very gracious.
Yeah.
And then I said, by the way, would you like to do an interview? So you, so far, so good. You're doing well. And I have to tell people that as an engineer, I was fascinated. This was not a, well, we have this many models and just pick out a color and off you go. You actually make each stove
on order.
On order. And there are many things to choose from. Tell us, what are all the various things that you can choose? Not a not big exhaustive list, but sort of in a general category. What are the things people might choose?
Well, people, we give the choice to people to make their own selection and design their own cooker, basically, starting almost from scratch. But that requires a specific production organization, and that's the challenge in many ways. So our knowledge, our know-how is how to combine craftsmanship and industrial processes. And that makes the product quite exclusive in many ways, dedicated to the end user, the person who makes the choice of his or her own cooker.
And what are the kinds of things you can choose?
So you can choose among different types of gas burners, induction hobs, plancha, griddles, char grills, steamers.
The traditional French plate.
The steamer plate, yes, absolutely. The French top, yeah.
And would you explain to people what a French top is?
The French top is literally a big cooking surface made of cast iron on which you can simmer and sear. So you can do both according to the location of your casserole. Basically, so it might be very warm in the middle and a little bit softer on the sides.
I've seen people take their pots and move them to the edge and come back in.
Yeah, that's the way to adjust the heat according to your preparation.
And you could see where underneath, back when you were just making fire, whether it was coal or wood.
It used to be coal before.
It used to be coal, and it's like, well, that's, you'd put this on top and you'd cook everything on top of it.
Yes, absolutely, yeah.
And that's why it's traditional, but you still have that as a part of a stove,
exactly.
As an option.
Yes.
And when you started out, the stoves were black.
They were originally black, yes. And then with all the research and sophistication that were implemented in the early, but forever actually, enamel has been in color for many, many centuries, I would say. Even the Romans were using enamel for their own pots and utensils.
Enamel on the outside.
Enamel, yes. This is not paint coating, actually. This is proper enamel, which is very specific and very sophisticated as in terms of brightness and choice of colors. And so, yes, we have now 24 different colors that you can choose and select. But we make sometimes also a color and bespoke according to specific requirements.
A one-off color.
Yes.
I hadn't thought of that.
Yeah, but it takes a little bit longer because we need to make sure the color will fit the specifications. But we can make it, yes. And our enameling facility is one of the last available in Europe, I mean, for that type of job.
I actually didn't think to do an interview until I began to understand how this all comes together. They are one-off, and yet there are some things that are common, everything is individual. You don't have a single, well, we'll build this and someone will buy it. Everything is individual. And there's a whole different philosophy about producing these than we usually see today. We're so used to economies of scale.
Yes, absolutely. And we like manufacturing products that are dedicated to one person, to one end user. And we like the idea of that user keeping this appliance for decades, actually. So, I mean, we are against, I would say, scheduled obsolescence.
Planned obsolescence,
yes,
not for
yes.
you.
And this is not our philosophy. We are more keen on making sure that the day's appliances will be working and reliable for many years. And also, we try to, and we do our best to preserve all the components that are used for one appliance available for the future. So that means that somebody in 30 years will be able to find some spares for replacement.
On the outside, these stoves look the same, except for colors. Mm-hmm. Occasionally we add a few more new colors over time. But actually on the inside, you're also changing the technology to improve it.
Yes, because we don't throw away all the developments and research and development that can be implemented in a cooker. We try to adopt and insert new technologies and new improvements in components and spares. But from outside, it has to look a little bit timeless. And we like the idea of keeping the same design, which is related to the brand. But also, we want to improve the product step by step, according to the developments we can implement. Yeah.
I know. I wanted one with pilot lights, and you said, "I'm sorry, we do."
No more pilot lights.
When was the last time you made them with pilot lights?
Well, probably 15, 20 years ago.
Darn, 15 years too late, huh?
But if you have a special request, maybe we can try to develop something specific, I would say.
I would say. And that's probably true for many things. Since
yes.
each stove is unique,
mm-hmm.
you could say you have the unique colors available if mm-hmm. you would like to try.
Mm-hmm.
So this is the kind of thing that we just don't... You have to wrap your head around today with technology.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking about a piece of technology,
mm-hmm.
and yet it is bespoke, as we used to
yes.
say, for the individual. This mm-hmm. is completely different than we are used to.
Yes, absolutely. But in the meantime, we have to cope with the safety regulations and all the approvals that are... also required because we can't do anything without taking into consideration all the rules regarding consumer safety and all these kind of things. Actually, this is compulsory.
Now, I walked through the...
No shortcuts.
Now, I walked through the manufacturing line and I saw a lot of robotics equipment. So it's not like you're starting with the iron in the ground and then producing a stove.
Mm-hmm.
There is a series of processes which can be, I guess, generally produced.
Mm-hmm. Yes. The production equipment have to be completely updated as well. There is a concern about... production costs, obviously. I mean, you can be inspired by very good aims and targets, but at the same time, you need to consider the production cost, and you have to make sure that the product will be affordable. And it doesn't make any sense manufacturing something if people can't buy it. And also because it does have something to do with with labor, with human labor and skills as well. So you can be modern. You have to be modern, even if you consider that former way of manufacturing or the old way of manufacturing is at some point interesting in the way that you can specialize and manufacture on bespoke devices or equipment.
Now, I saw a number of instances. I will call them stations, if you will, whether it was testing or putting some things together. And of course, it is, each of those are one stove. They're working on this stove, this order. You can always see whose order it is. How skilled are those laborers? Is that they can they just go down a list and follow it, or is this a skill?
No, this is a skill, and you cannot learn from schools or whatever. You need to be taught by the people who have already learned and who have already manufactured the product before. So this is an internal know-how, savoir-faire, as we say in French. And that savoir-faire, this know-how, is transmitted from one person to another.
Your father was before you. There are many generations here. We're still in Lacanche, France, 650 people. I don't know how many people were here before, but we know how many people are here now. Of the workers, the 130-odd workers you have here today, how many have represent generations of people who have worked here?
I would say a third of the people who are now working in the company already had one of their grandfather or father working in the company before. And it's a little bit a matter of pride for them, for some of them, and they like it. They like the idea of being the successor of their father or their grandfather or their grandmother at some point.
Because
there were some women working in the company as well.
Well, foundries were classically male.
Yes, absolutely. But there were some other tasks and some other skills that only women could take care of. Yeah.
I know. I saw a woman today. She was coming at me with a forklift. So I know they're working in a lot of jobs.
And at some point, enameling as well.
It's a different concept that you could continue today to do this. Because in a real sense, in technology, we keep saying, oh, you can't make that business work. That's not going to work. And yet today you are. How many ranges do you produce a year?
We produce between 4,000 and 4,500 pieces a year.
And where do they go in the world?
They go mainly to France, which is still a very substantial market for us, but also in Europe, the States, and in another country a little bit far away from Australia or South Africa or even Chile or Canada, possibly.
They're going everywhere.
Everywhere.
Well, Jean-Jacques, thank you so much for joining us. I hope you come back. See you soon.
Thank you.
I've been speaking with Jean-Jacques Augeneur, the CEO of Lacanche. More Lacanche to come after a break. Podcasts of TechNation and TechNation Health are available at NPR One, iTunes, Stitcher, and other podcast syndication outlets. Coming up in the second half of our show, I speak with the Director of Export at Lacanche, Chef Patrick Roigeau. Stay with us. You're listening to Tech Nation. In Chef Patrick Boisjoe's career, he's been a restaurateur, a teacher, and a professional chef, including being the former head chef at the French Embassy in New York. Today, he is the director of export at La Conche. I started out by asking him about the challenge of building stoves here in La Conche and shipping them to the world.
You're entirely right. We build these units that are heavy and bespoke, and we ship them. Well, at the other end, we need to have an entity, partners, that will basically pick up those units, check them out, make sure that they're okay, because traveling doesn't work always the way you want, and then bring them to the final customer, install them, make sure that they work properly, and to a certain extent, train them on it. And my role here is to basically take those distributors. We have normally one distributor per country, and train them on our product so they can pass on the information to the final customer at the other end.
Well, here we have a stove. I mean, who doesn't know how to use a stove, right?
Maybe. A lot of people. Just like a lot of people, you know, buy cars and they don't know how to drive on a racetrack. You know, I mean, we all face this dilemma sometimes, you know. I mean, so long as we don't have a problem or an accident, you know, or the road is smooth, then everything goes well. And then all of a sudden, if you have a problem with driving, you know quickly your limitations.
Now, I was just speaking with Jean-Jacques, and we were talking about the traditional French plate. Tell us how you actually cook with a French plate. What can you do with it, and what can't you do with it?
Well, we call it the plaque coup de feu, you know, which means the fire shot. Okay, and basically you imagine, as you described it, a plate of steel, you know, a plate of cast iron, actually 12 kilos of cast iron, with a hole in the middle and a burner or gas burner, gas flame underneath at the center. And once you turn this on, that cast iron plate becomes obviously hot, and the heat spreads very quickly and evenly on that plate. And then from there, depending on where you put the pot on that plate, you will get more or less heat. So it's, in a way, it's sort of a hot plate where you can have on one end, you know, at one edge, you're going to have something simmering, and at the center, you're going to have something boiling.
And let's be clear, this isn't a small plate. This
is
perhaps 15 inches across,
yeah.
And 24 inches.
24 inches, yeah, exactly.
This is one big piece.
Oh, it's a big piece of
cast iron.
And it has a lot of inertia, obviously. So some people get, it takes some getting used to, because the inertia, what I mean by that is when the plate is hot, you just don't turn down the heat and expect it to cool down in the next 3 minutes. It's going to take 3 hours to cool down. Okay, so you need to learn how to use it in order to simmer on it. And at the same time, it's called a fire shot, because at some point, if you need to have an open flame, all you need to do is to remove that center ring, and then you are directly on the open burner. And at this point, you can have the highest, you know, heat you can have.
How hot is that burner?
It's a little more than 18,000 BTUs.
Okay, singe your hair off.
Yes, it could be. Yeah, it can burn you, depending on what you do with it. Yeah, you don't want the cat to run on the plate at that point.
Good time for training.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
What would be foods familiar to people that they would cook on a French plate?
Oh, you would probably do a lot of stewing. You know,
long time, lower heat.
Yeah, exactly. Low heat, simmering. You know, it's directly inspired by the what you find in restaurants. And in restaurants, basically during the service, you know, the time where you actually cook and serve people, these hot plates were and still are used so you can actually put things on hold while other things are cooking.
By moving them around.
Exactly. You move them around. It's sort of a ballet of pots and, you know, moving. So a lot of people do that as well. You know, they are able to cook for their family or their friends or whatever while, you know, the sauce is simmering on at one end and then they're sauteing something on the other end. And that is in the ideal world. In reality, it takes, as I say, some getting used to, some training, but for some avid cooks, it is irreplaceable.
And so you have that. That's maybe one of the things that you've mm-hmm. chosen. And then you've got other burners mm-hmm. that are more familiar yeah. to people.
That's true. Yeah, we have. We can. If you imagine your plain table, the top of your range, basically you have a choice of 8 different options, aside from your basic gas burners. So you have your basic gas burners, right? And then next to that, you have 8 other options that you can put in. As you mentioned, the hot plates, but you can also, we have a wonderful multi-cooker, we call it, which is a steamer cooker, where you can steam food, you can poach food, you can cook food as a double boiler. We have a deep.
That's all in one thing.
Yes. Yes, we have a plancha, which I believe we experienced today.
Right, but tell people what a plancha is.
Well, the plancha is you imagine a sort of a embedded pan, right?
Big
rectangular plate, which would be a perfectly smooth, flat, non-stick, because it's lined with chrome, non-stick pan, which has the advantage of having a thermostat. So you can actually heat up that pan to the exact temperature you want. Unlike a pan where you put the pan on the burner, it's going to get hot. And at some point, you have to somewhat guess how hot it is before you put the food in. So there's, you know, some chefs have tricks, some sparkle of water or something to give you an idea of how hot it is. In this case, you actually have a thermostat. So you can actually set the temperature of that plate to the degree you want, which means that if you cook salmon like we did for lunch, that salmon will be cooking, and I'm talking about in Celsius here, but I can translate roughly at 400 degrees temperature of the surface. So you're going to get a beautiful caramelization without any burning. But then if you have something that needs more caramelization, you can go up or down. And
like a steak would be higher.
Exactly. Or if you want to cook eggs, for instance, you would probably lower it so it doesn't fry, you know, and it stays nice and moist. So
this has a little trough all around.
Exactly.
The
yes.
So that, you know, little, if whatever you have coming over can run off the side.
Exactly. In the case today, we had the salmon, and the salmon gives out some oil, you know, that's natural. And that oil basically runs off and gets caught into that little groove on the edge. And because it is chrome and it's non-reactive, you can also deglaze. You know what deglazing is, you know, you would take some sort of a liquid and pour it on it, so it would pick up all the caramelized proteins and turn it into a nice jus, you know. And so it's a very interesting tool. The beauty of it, we can also use it as a simmering plate, because you can actually set pots on it. And yeah, you hear in the background we have all these noise from
what
the factory.
What is all that? This is a very authentic interview.
Yeah, well, yeah, it's people are working here. So there's many things you can do with that plancha, and that's one of our options. We also have induction burners, induction
the
hubs.
Flat, yes. Looks like glass that
exactly.
you would see, and mm-hmm. you can move your plates around.
Which,
there. But very hot though.
Well, and they run. Yeah, it's a new somewhat new technology. It's not that new anymore. But in the States, I think it's making its way now at home. And once you try induction, it's hard not to fall in love with it. It's a very very good heating and cooking technology.
So if I had a pot of water on a normal big gas burner mm-hmm. and I turned it all the way up, mm-hmm. how long would that take me to get to boil?
Let's put it this way. You have a pot, and let's start with two of the same exact parts, okay? Because of course the parts have a big. So let's start by saying first you have the same part on both burners. Yeah, and you will start with 1/4 water in each at the same temperature. You turn on both burners. One is an induction burner. It's about 1800 watts, which amounts to about, if I'm not mistaken, 5,000 BTUs.
And then, this is electric.
It's electric. And then the other one is gas, and it would be a 4 kilowatt burner, which amounts to about 12,000 BTUs. Okay, let's assume. Well, I turn them on exactly at the same time. The induction will bring the water to a boil in about 1 minute and 10 seconds. The water on the gas burner will probably start boiling after 4 minutes.
That's the old-fashioned way.
Well,
that's how we're used to.
Yes and no, because you cannot. I mean, there's some good advantage to induction. There's also some things about gas that you cannot replace. I always compare it to the digital and analogical world. Okay, induction is digital. It has this sort of clinical feel to it because you have no clue. You don't have heat coming out. You don't have the flame color coming out. You don't have anything to tell you how it,
you got to just read the number.
You just read the number. Where gas has all this organic aspect, you know, that sort of a poetic organic thing, you know, that gives gas what it is. So you turn it on, you turn it down, you feel it, you see it, it's blue, it has all these things that, and you feel the heat coming at you and all these things that you cannot replace. So some people love induction, some people love gas. People like me as a professional, I like both. I like to cook on gas sometimes for some things, and I like to cook on induction for other things. But I don't think one is better than the other. It's just two different technology.
Now, I see that with the gas burners, which we all would assume, okay, you're going to select some gas burners on the top if you didn't choose induction as example. Some of them are small rings. Mm-hmm. Some of them are big rings.
That's true.
What are the choices there?
Well, I mean...
And why would you choose each?
Well, a gas burner, it's extremely complicated, if not impossible, to get a gas burner to heat up from a very low end, let's say 0.1, BTU or kilowatt, rather, to a very high end. Because the range is very long and very large, and very often you're going to have to stop either before it's too low or before it's too high. So what happened is we have three size burners, four actually. So you have the small burner when you really want something of a very, very low heat.
A really low sauce.
Very low, exactly. Simmering.
You're down there at the bottom of your burner is it going to go out?
Exactly. And then at the other end, we have the biggest burner we have, which is the 18,000 BTU burner, who will give you the most power. And if you turn it down to its minimum, it reaches a level which is about half of the power of the 4 kilowatt burner, which is the next size down, and so on and so forth.
So they all overlap each other.
They overlap each other, and that's how you basically choose the size of your burner.
So you have a big pot of water on a gas stove. Mm-hmm. You want the big burner, and then you have some little sauce for them, and then you put that on the little one, and then they all get together
exactly.
as a meal.
Exactly. And the induction has also different size burners, you know, but the induction has the ability, because it's electricity, it has the ability to go much lower or much higher than gas, but it doesn't function on the same, as I explained earlier, on the same feel, you know.
You turn gas down, it's down. Now, your pot may still be hot.
Exactly.
Yeah,
to me, gas is very, as I say, very poetic, very, it's much more in tune with the love of cooking and how it interacts with you. Induction doesn't interact with you. Induction is matter of fact, it's clinical. You tell me it's number three, that's what it is. You know, level three, level four, level five. Gas is not like that. Depends on the kind of gas you're using, the power you have at your house, I mean, the kind of gas inlet you have. You know, all these things change. And some people love it, and some people simply don't prefer to have something very clinical. That's why we offer both.
Having spoken with two people today who each ordered, independent of mm-hmm. each other, live in different areas of the United States, each ordered a Lacanche stove, they just talked about this struggle of, and then there's the ovens and the warming mm-hmm. drawers, which mm-hmm. can also cook as an oven, and you do different things. The struggle they each described mm-hmm. independently is saying, mm-hmm. you know, if you just go down to the store and say, well, what model is this? And I'll take exactly. a couple of options. That is what we're used to on the yes. great economy of scale, mm-hmm. mass production. There are more limited things. No one had ever been through an experience like this where you had to choose it because it is truly bespoke. This is your stove.
That's right. Exactly. And we're very proud of that. And at the same time, it's a dilemma for most of our clients. And that's why the training of our distributor is so important. Because they need to lead, they need to help the client going through. Let me tell you something. Do you know, you've been here for a full day and you've seen everything, and maybe you know that the answer to this question, but it's my turn to give you a question. How many possibilities do you think we have? If you sit down today and say, I want a Lacanche stove, okay, I don't know what size, I don't know what color, I don't know what configuration, I don't know whatever. What can you give me? How many possible options or possible models you can have?
Well, let's see. On the top, we have 8 or 10, we decided. Mm-hmm. There are 10 different options there. And then we have different sizes that go mm-hmm. up. And
45.
45. So
45 size.
It's 45.
45 models.
Models. Okay. So 45 times 45. I'll say.
That's right. Okay. Then you have 24 colors.
Oh, and 24 colors.
That's right. Then you have 5 different finishes, trims.
Okay.
Then you have, as you mentioned, 8 options. Then you have 4 different kind of ovens. And then you have... I don't remember the number, but you have a certain amount of number of configuration on surface, right or left.
Oh, that's right. You can flip
that's
them
right.
the way you
exactly.
want.
Exactly. Do you know how much it amounts to?
Oh, yeah.
How
it's many? Just short of infinity.
Well, not infinity, but almost. It's about 300,000.
300,000. So odds that the two people
exactly.
have identical stoves.
Exactly.
There must be a popular.
Yeah. Well, we don't sell 300,000, different models No. But it's true. Yeah, we tend to sell some models more than others. But literally, if you were to really put it down on paper, we have the possibility of doing 300,000 different models. What we face every day. I mean.
And now you have you produce these ranges. They mm-hmm. get delivered all over the world, all over mm-hmm. France and all over the world. And the person who has bought it said, okay, I ordered the whole thing. Here it is. This big, beautiful range is here. How do I cook on it? What do they expect that maybe...
That's right.
They may not be able to come up to their mm-hmm. expectations.
That is very interesting. That's a very interesting question. And at this point, it's a dilemma for us because a lot of what has been done in the industry, domestic appliance industry, is to make ranges or in ovens and cooktops and things somewhat of miracle machines, that you don't want to think. You take something, you write, you take a recipe, you put ingredients together, you pop it in the oven, you close the oven, and then you come back 25 minutes later and it's supposed to be fine. That's what we are told, to a point where the industry now sometimes doesn't even put temperature anymore on the knobs. They put names, like you have a program for tarts and you have a program for chicken and you have a program for, you hope that it's the same chicken that the guy who made the program, used, because otherwise you're in trouble. But anyway... Well, the antithesis of that, what we do is we provide you with a very simple tool that gives you the temperature of your oven, that gives you a good, obviously a good oven or a good, and then from there you, it's up to you to make it work the right way for you. So there's a learning curve, and we are here, of course, to consult our customers. But most people in the beginning ask us, well, don't you have some sort of a program, you know, for when I make a quiche, you know, how much? Well, you know, when you make a quiche, you need an oven and you need a mold and you need a recipe and you need all that, and you need you also. You need to have, you need to be there and understand what, you know. So it becomes a little bit like, I always make this comparison with cars, because I think we all know what cars are, you know. Some people like cars because they do everything for them. They don't think, you know, they turn on the key and then the car just tells them, you know, what to do and how to do it. And if they fall asleep, it tells them. And some other people like cars because they like driving. Our ranges are made for people who like cooking. And doesn't mean that you need to know how to cook. But when you, on our ranges, when you cook, the result will be exactly what you expect it to be, depending on what you put in. I don't know if it's quite clear, but it's not a miracle machine. It's just a very, very good, reliable, non-electronic or very little electronic machine that's going to be your partner. It's like your sous chef, you know?
And it's going to be your sous chef for, I guess, 30 or 40 years.
For 30 years, exactly, exactly. It's reliable. Every time you're going to need it, it's going to be there, and it's going to respond the exact same way. And once you know how to do something with it, it will repeat and repeat and repeat without any problems.
And what does that anymore?
Exactly, exactly. What does that anymore? You're right. I mean, we're very proud of the fact that we are one of the last company that actually hangs on to its tradition and working in France and making things differently. You know, we don't, you've been in the factory, you've seen that we don't pop out units one after the other, and we don't have any stock. If you come today, you cannot come to us and say, oh, you know, I want this range, can you pull out one out of the shelf? No. If you want a range, you're going to have to order it. And we're going to start building it once it's ordered. Who does that? Who does that? Very, very little. You know, it's a very interesting business model. A lot of people walk away from it because they would say, wow, my God, it doesn't make any sense. I mean, you know, you need stock, you need... Well, it works for us, obviously, for the last 30 years. And it keeps working because we're growing. We're growing at a very good rate.
Well, I would also say... Your assembly line is interesting because mm-hmm. there are rollers, and mm-hmm. between the rollers, there are pieces of wood, and mm-hmm. and the stoves are on just very worn pieces of
That's
wood,
right,
and you
yeah.
just kind of roll them along from mm-hmm. one station to the other so that mm-hmm. they can get one thing done
yes, exactly.
at a time.
Exactly,
it's like
yeah.
you have an assembly
have,
line,
oh, yeah.
it just doesn't look like
no.
General Motors in Detroit.
Sure, exactly, yeah. You know, in some cases, you have about 12 to 15 people actually working on one unit. I mean, you know, adding things to it and building it. And in at the other end, when we're talking about a very big unit, which cannot be obviously produced on a sort of a assembly line, because
right.
we don't know what, you know, we could not create a process for that because we don't know what the range is going to be. Then we have one person working on it. Only one from start to finish is going to start from a piece of wood, on a piece of wood meaning a pallet, okay, not, and then on that pallet is going to build the range from the bottom up, and at the end sign it, sign off, and then we ship it. So it's all literally made by hand. And of course, we are very proud of the fact that they are also made, they are all these beautiful colors that you've seen are, this is not paint, it's enamel. And enamel has nothing to do with paint, basically, because it's melted glass. It's, you imagine that we spend a great deal of time and effort to create this finish, which is a thin layer of melted glass, which is melted on metal. And it gives us a lot of trouble to make it, because it's precious. It's like jewel.
In fact, even though we have a number of colors, mm-hmm. you don't say, well, we have a batch of doors over mm-hmm. here, because you have to do all of the processes to put the enamel on for a single stove at once, because every batch of enamel could be different.
Of course, because it's all natural product. I mean, enamel is basically, the enameling process is a process where you take sand, a glass basically, and that you put natural pigments in it. So it could be cobalt that comes from South Africa or South America. And depending on where it comes from, the blue is not going to be, it's not going to be the same. And then you're going to mix it with water, and you're going to mix it with clay, and then you're going to spray it on the metal, and then you're going to bake that metal at about 800 degrees Celsius. I'll let you do the calculation in Fahrenheit. And we have to do that three times, and sometimes even four times, meaning four layers. And of course, we all seen, images of people doing pottery, and they paint the thing before baking it, and when it comes out, it doesn't have in the same color at all. Well, that's the same thing for us. Once the door or the paneling has gone through the oven, it comes out, and it's blue, okay, fine. But now, if the next day we do another batch and then we run it again, the blue won't be the same.
So you do
Exactly. So we have one person at the enamel factory. Her job is to take every day the products, the base products that we have, mix it, make a tiny sample until she reaches the closest color to the basic color we want. Then she writes the recipe and passes it on to the person who makes the batch.
For that day.
For that day.
Because times have changed, humidity has changed.
Yeah, and again, maybe the supply we have is run out, and now we have again cobalt from nature. Doesn't give you, a constant product, and that's the same thing about cooking. I mean, one day you have a big tomato, the next day it's small, the third day it's green, the fourth day it's nice and juicy. You have to adapt. That's what we do.
Well, Patrick, I could talk to you for about 3 days, I know you have work to do, and so do I. So I appreciate you so much. I hope you come back and see us again.
Yes, thank you, and it's a pleasure to meet you.
Many thanks to Lacanche, to CEO Jean-Jacques Augeneur, and Director of Export, Chef Patrick Boisjot. More information is available at FrenchRanges.com or Lacanche.com. That's LACANCHE. Lacanche.com. For TechNation, I'm Moira Gunn.
TechNation and its regular segment, BiotechNation, are produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. Executive producer is Matt Gardner. The director of technical production is Monte Carlos. And audio engineers include Howard Gelman, Seal Mahler, and Larry Upton. Our theme music was composed by Ann Nachtrieb-Zesiger and Robert Powell, with title creation provided by NameLab Incorporated of San Francisco. Program information and internet audio is available on the web at technation.com. TechNation and BiotechNation are productions of TechNation Media. I'm Paul Landcor.